Byron, could you answer again from a high level, what is a pub sub architecture specifically as it relates to kind of back-end development? And like, what should we compare and contrast it to make sense of it? Before we jump into today's conversation, I've got a recommendation. Jonathan Hall, a friend of mine who was on the show 10 or so episodes back, well, he's got his own podcast that you should definitely check out. It's called Cup O Go. And we do talk a lot about Go development here on this podcast, but we also talk about a lot of other stuff. And Cup O Go is a great podcast if you really just want to keep going deeper on the Go programming language. So Cup O Go, go check them out. They're on all the major podcasting platforms and on YouTube. Welcome to this episode of Backend Banter. I'm super excited. I've got two engineers here from Synadia. Now, this, of course, is the show about backend development and backend careers, but today we're going to dive into kind of more specifically pub sub architecture, something we haven't really had a chance to talk about on the show yet. So I've got Byron Ruth and David Gee today with me. I want you guys to go ahead and just give a quick introduction. Byron, do you want to start off?
Oh yeah, sure. Thanks for having us. And yeah, so I actually came originally from the healthcare background. So I was in biomedical research for 15 years prior to joining Synadia. So I have a lot of experience. I manage a couple software teams building tech to facilitate pediatric research. I've been a longtime NATS user, which we'll get into probably later in the episode. We'll bring that up. And yeah, so joined Synadia about a year and a half ago and have been doing primarily developer relations, but I'm also doing the NATS FM podcast with David and also a release manager for the NATS server itself.
Oh, very
So,
cool.
yeah.
Yeah, amazing. Thanks for that. David, you want to go ahead?
Yeah, sure. Yeah, no pressure on Byron. He's got all the hard things to deal with. Yeah. So, hi, I'm David G. Been a network kind of software engineer, network designer, architect for 20 years or so. Drawn to the communication landscape, and I've kind of been fortunate enough, even though I live in the UK, to work for a lot of kind of blue chips and the large network vendors. But I started out in life as an electronics engineer, working, believe it or not, on distributed machinery, where you have a communication system on a machine, and then it became how to make those machines communicate together on a factory floor. And then that's how I got into networking in the first place, because I realized there was more money to be made building networks than there was machinery. But the love for the machinery and how they communicate never went away. So I then got involved heavily in communications and software. And I've kind of like, the pendulum's swung the opposite way. And I'm back now in software, looking at communications and not the physical aspects. So yeah, over Synadia, I've got like a million hats, maybe not a million, maybe about four, but a little bit of DevRel, a little bit of community, a little bit of engineering, a lot of customer facing stuff. And I'm fortunate as well for Amir to go to a lot of the conferences and talks and represent the NATS project and Synadia as well.
Yeah, well, I mean, I was amazed when I was just talking to Byron before we went live. Synadia is about 40 people, and I've worked at companies of much larger than 40 people that I don't think were quite as well known for their product. So, I mean, I've heard of NATS independently, obviously, before we kind of connected on Twitter to put this episode together. But you guys are doing some pretty cool things with only 40 people. One kind of preliminary question I have before we even dive into the more technical stuff is just like, what's the seniority level like over at Synadia? Like, is everyone this like tenured, 10-year senior developer, or do you have a pretty wide mix of junior up to senior?
Got to watch what we say here, but yes, that generally true. There's a lot of really, really senior people there, have diverse backgrounds, a lot of people clearly in messaging, pub sub type stuff. And
Right.
yeah, it's really fun. That was actually one of the reasons why I personally wanted, given the opportunity, I wanted to join because I knew I was going to be working with a whole bunch of really senior people with, again, diverse backgrounds. And I knew, like, I have this, my personal opinion is that I enjoy being surrounded by people who are much smarter than me. So I wanted to take advantage of that. joining Synadia. So it's been a good time. And I think at the same time, we all play off one another fairly well. And we respect one another. So that's it's been a good time for me personally.
I think that's great advice generally. So there's the story of like, there's Bill Murray. Is it David Aykroyd? Like the guys from the Ghostbusters movie, the original mm-hmm. Ghostbusters movie. And there's a famous quote, and I'm going to butcher it because I can't remember which one of them said it. But basically, if you find yourself as like the best actor in the room, like you need to find a new room, right? Because like you kind of stop learning, which is unfortunate because if you take any room, there's always going to be a best person in that room. You just don't want to be that person, right? So I think it makes a lot mm-hmm. of sense to continuously try to seek out either new organizations or new teams where you have seniors to learn from.
It's interesting,
sounds like Synadia. Yeah.
It's really interesting. I think the things with NATS that we come across though as well, the general width and breadth and depth of what we've got going on and what we interact with. You know, one day you're an expert in top one topic and the next day you are completely fresh. You're not winging it, but you're hot on the heels of going, I don't know where to begin with this. And then luckily somebody in the team somewhere leans in and you think, oh, and that's why I love this place.
Yeah,
it's great.
And just on that, to second that point, yeah, it's like the stuff that we're doing with NATS, and again, we'll get into the pub sub more generally, we'll take a step back, but like we're working with distributed systems at the end of the day. And there are so many aspects to that, clearly. And it's like, there's a lot of moving parts. You have to consider architecture and yeah, you might have a person on the team who just like really knows RAF consensus super well, or really understands, you know, the mechanics of that. And then someone's else like topology design, how do you create this like hub and spoke model properly to power cars and blah, blah, blah. Like there's all sorts of deep knowledge. Everyone has a really great breadth, but yeah, you definitely encounter different people who have very deep vertical backgrounds. So it's very fun. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's one of the more complex topics. So in my 4-year CS degree, I think my hardest, my like quote unquote hardest class, just from a conceptual standpoint, was probably computational theory, which was like Turing machines, finite automata. But then the second hardest class was probably distributed systems. From a coding perspective, it was definitely distributed systems. Computational theory was like all theoretical, right? It was like, oh, maybe like in the future, this will matter. Like I haven't had to worry about finite automata in my day job as a backend developer yet. But distributed systems very much so, especially, you know, in the last decade, a lot of progress has been made. So let's, like you said, let's zoom out. And I just want to talk about just really quick before we even talk about specifically PubSub, let's talk about what is a distributed system. Could you maybe answer that, David?
A distributed system. Oh, I knew you was going to call my name out there. A distributed system. Okay. So I think the easiest way to mentally project this, if we take something to be done, so let's come up with a complex calculation. Instead of doing that in one place, in one algorithm, on one runtime, let's split that apart into separate chunks and let's source parts of the inputs, parts of the calculation, and let's stitch it all back together to try and provide a single answer. And we're going to get all sorts of fun with that. We're going to have fast paths and slow paths, and we might have errors and all sorts of things. But it's when we don't have visibility of doing a single job in a single place, and we lose visibility of that and spread it around to different parts. And that might be for different reasons: power, latency, just user experience, you know, language localization, regulatory, who knows? I mean, Byron, I'm going to do that thing. Go, what do you think, Byron? Is that reasonable? Did I do it justice?
Yeah, I was going to butcher Leslie Lamport's quote of saying distributed system is one that a computer can basically make your computer not work anymore. A failure in one cloud. It's like, okay, it's
distributes
not like
failures.
Yeah, because if you think of it, it's the fundamental term here is it's a system. It's not just independent distributed computers, right, that aren't talking to one another. So there's connectivity, there's communication happening between them, whether you're breaking up some work and they have to, you know, coordinate and do something, or you're scaling out and whatever it may be. You in the non-happy path case, in the happy path, if you design it properly, everything should go swimmingly and great. But the second you have a fault somewhere, that's where distributed systems gets hard. And you're like, okay, if I have, you know, I'm distributing load across these three computers, and let's say it's a simple work queue or something, and, you know, I'm taking off these jobs and I'm processing within some amount of time. What if the third server goes down and now all the load is now being redistributed to your two servers? If they can't keep up, they're eventually going to fall over as well. And then you're down to nothing. So it's one of those cases of saying, understanding your fault domains within your system. And, there's human systems and distributed systems, whether they're like computers or humans in the loop and that kind of thing. But you have to understand where your areas of fault are and understand, you know, if this happens, how isolated is it? What's the blast radius? Is it what's the ripple effect going to have across the system? And so it is, you can build a distributed system for various reasons. People gravitate, they hear buzzwords like microservices and they're like, that seems cool. I should just go do that. And it's like, well, you have to have a reason for doing it. Like, don't jump to that conclusion. But it's like a simple one is like, I want to use two different programming languages. So I need two services. So now I have to have network communication, or I have a certain problem that needs to scale, given the input, as David said. And it's like, you have to break up the work. You physically can't, you get crazy computers in the cloud today that have massive amount of hardware, but you're also spending, $2,500 a month to afford it. You can maybe have commodity hardware that you can just split the problem up more. So you got to know, why you're building a distributed system in the first place, high availability, replication, what have you, breaking up work. But yeah, it fundamentally is these things are all coordinated in some form or fashion together. It's independent processes or physical machines.
Yeah. Can I step in? I know this is going to be the longest intro question ever, the longest possible answer. But I think this is going to be for later on. All right, ready for this one? This is going to be a curveball, like a boomerang, and later on it's going to come back. I promise. So Google is a really good, and that's not me saying go and Google it. No, Google is a system is really interesting because it set an expectation of what a distributed system is. So Google on a good day, if you go and go, what is a penguin? And it might come back and it will give you different breeds, where they are, their kind of eating habits, and everything else. On a bad day, it might come back and say it's a bird thing that's got some flippers, whatever, because it's not offline. And what happens with these systems is you build them for survivability as well. So, an experience, you might say, my distributed system can never be offline. Something always needs to happen. So in terms of Google, it's like parts of it it's always broken in some degree, but it's always functional in your mind's eye. So you're going to get an answer. It might not be a very good answer today, or, the algorithm's broken or whatever it is. I think these conversations are always great because with NATS and what we do for a living, we can attack this from so many different ways, whether it's programming language and, skill in a different team and whatever, pick your poison, functional versus, imperative and stuff. We've got all the kind of different corner cases covered, but they allow you to build the systems that people expect when you use the word distributed.
Right.
And then and boomerang I'll, thrown.
And I'll throw one final term and I won't say anymore, but for web developers, you might be able to think of it as progressive enhancement, in the sense that you want to be able to have this ability to have a minimum functioning thing, like the bird with flippers. But if you can go beyond that, if certain elements of the page can render better and improve the experience, JavaScript can load, all this kind of stuff, you're enhancing the functionality or the experience that you're providing. But the goal is to, like David said, survivability. It's like, you want that minimum, I can render in my, a web page in my terminal. I'm blanking even on the names of those programs right now. But it's like this ability to have the minimum information available that will still get the job done. But if the experience can be improved beyond that, that's sort of one of those factors as well.
Yeah. Progressive enhancement is an interesting way, I think, to come at the definition of a distributed system. So let me kind of echo back some of what I heard, and you guys can tell me if I'm on the right track. So a non-distributed system might be, for example, I'm running let's just say I have a very typical kind of CRUD application backend. So I've got my server written in Go, and it responds with JSON resources when they're requested over HTTP, right? If I'm running that on my local machine, one instance of that, and it's connected to a local Postgres database, we might not call that a distributed system. We might refer to that as a monolith, right? Kind of one one server doing one thing. But if we took that service and distributed it across, I don't know, 10 or 20 different servers, so different machines running the cloud, slapped a load balancer in front of it, and now they're all communicating with either with each other and with the load balancer and responding to requests, could we consider that a distributed system?
This is a lovely question. you want to go for that?
I know that
one,
it's
David?
Like a very simple one, because they're not necessarily. Well, I'll let you guys answer. Yeah,
go on, Byron.
All right, I'll start.
I'll give you the first shot. Go for it.
Yeah. So I think that is a distributed system, first and foremost, because you have at a minimum, you know, two components. You have the web server has your application on it, whether it's a monolithic application or not, Ruby on Rails, Django, what have you, Laravel. But then you have this database dependency. If that database is offline, your application is going to break in a variety of ways. So it's a unit. It's a unit of, you know, that has a particular responsibility, no different than if you implemented two different services that I'm, you know, an addition function and a subtraction function, you know, everyone's loving lambdas. And you can have like these two things. Well, part of your service is going to not work. You know, that client experience, that client interaction. If I try to subtraction and it's offline, it's not going to work. And so if you hit an API endpoint that requires the database and it's offline, it's not going to work. And so the question is like, when you do, you know, distributed system design, and I would include that there, it's like, well, what is the experience like if it fails, if the database is offline and that happy path fails? One example could be, for instance, if you had a local cache in your application server in process that just basically returned a stale read, like a stale copy of the data, and it doesn't actually have to hit the database. So you have to make that trade-off to say, does this stale data, is that still useful enough for this particular API endpoint? Or do I really need the freshest data within a transaction in my database? And then writes are obviously different from reads and all that kind of stuff, but that is a distributed system. And then the second half of the question of saying, well, how would you, if you just replicated your application server, now, if you ask the question of replicating your database, that's a whole other fun ball of weeds, but the question there, if you wanted, you know, high availability of your application server, like you said, you know, three instances through a load balancer in front of it, by default, at least, they would all still be hitting the same database. So that's still the single point of failure at the end of the day. So if that's down, all three, it doesn't matter how highly available you get your application server, it's still not going to work in certain cases. Right. So that's where, I mean, distributed databases and all that kind of stuff are increasingly being adopted. And, you know, it's like, you just use a cloud database. They handle like HA and all that kind of stuff. And so don't worry about it. But David, any other additional points there?
I'm going to use the most famous term in IT. It depends. I think it depends which angle you're looking at things from. So what you described there, I think probably for the first time in my life ever disagree with Byron, certainly in public Where I think, that's all right. Don't worry.
That's why we call it back-end banter. Not... Yeah.
Yeah, there we go. I'd consider that just a vanilla load balance system, but there's a question, are all the load balance machines in the same rack? Are they in the same cloud and the same tenant? Are they on the same VPC? If they're all in the same general proximity, then what you're doing, you're load balancing a path. And I think for me, distributed systems is where aspects of a data journey have been spread around. So I'd probably make an addendum to that. Maybe you're getting the logo for your site from a local CDN coming in from somewhere entirely different from, you know, the initial load balance front end. You might have some, you know, sound effects coming from, you know, whatever, from a different place. You might be on your website subscribing to a random noise generator because, hey, you know, I like the way the wind sounds outside. I want a true random number source. I think when you try and build a system with inputs from different places, from different data sources. I don't just mean, you know, going through a load balancer for kind of HA or reliance or resiliency purposes. I think distributed means for me very, very different things than just kind of, you know, let's scale it up by sticking a load balancer on the front. And again, it's not to be offensive to anybody. It's just, I think things have, you know, that pattern was around for decades.
Yeah.
Not in so much distributed.
There's a no true Scotsman. I'm starting to hear like the beginnings of a no true Scotsman. Like that's not really a distributed system, even though it's spread across machines, because you know, this is a pattern that we've had for a while, or it doesn't solve all of the problems that we can solve with distributed systems, which I think is fair. Maybe it's best to think of distributed systems almost as like a gradient. And what I mean is, like, I could have a distributed system that's running just on my MacBook, right? And it's bound to like different ports, and they're communicating with each other. They're using distributed systems protocols, right? And balancing data across different services on my MacBook. But at the end of the day, if I drop my MacBook in a lake, like the system stops running, right? Which is one of the things that a distributed system is kind of supposed to solve. So like it's most basic, and again, kind of correct me if I'm wrong, I think of a distributed system as just kind of any system that requires components that are distributed across either, you know, ideally multiple machines, maybe just multiple processes when you're testing them. And some of the benefits of distributed systems include things like resiliency, right? Like hopefully if one component goes down, the rest of the system, kind of like to your point, David, earlier, can keep functioning, even if it means it has to function at like a lower level. Like maybe not all features are available, but at least most of them are. Or maybe all features are available. The quality of the responses just aren't as good. Are we kind of on the right track?
I like what you're saying there. So that whole thing of survivability for me defines it. I guess I always put a network slant on things. I know Byron, you know, takes the brunt of this most days, but I think if a user journey goes across a network and different points on the network, then it has a more distributed feel, even though you could build and emulate an entire system on your local machine. So that whole thing of, well, if my load balancer goes offline, what's happened? My whole user experience is dead. But in a truly distributed system, just realized I've mangled that word. You can talk about any cast, and you could have the same, yeah, your front end on the same IP. So if that goes offline and disappears from the default free internet route table or whatever, you'll get to the next one. And all of a sudden that for me becomes then all of a sudden interesting and distributed. In the true tense. But going back to your original one, where you've got a front end and a database, if you stand far enough back away from that, like you said, gradient, well, you've got two components having a conversation. So why isn't that distributed in its own right? Because it doesn't belong in, you know, one place. Anyway, I'm being a fool. But yeah, it's interesting combos.
No, that makes sense. Like in the example of like one database, three application servers, and one load balancer, you could argue there's maybe some distribution going on between the application servers, but you still have single points of failure at the database and at the load balancer level. So there are ways to distribute databases. There's ways to distribute other things. So we have like the beginnings of something interesting. So I want to now shift, and so we've talked about like kind of just the very high level, like what is a distributed system? It's this thing where we have many processes on many machines, hopefully that are resilient. And I want to narrow down our conversation now specifically to PubSub. Byron, could you answer again from a high level, what is a PubSub architecture specifically as it relates to kind of backend development? And like, what should we compare and contrast it to make sense of it?
Sure. Yeah. So PubSub is really a pattern. There's plenty of different ways to implement that in practice, and we'll get into, I guess, a couple implementations in a bit. But yeah, so I'll start actually with the contrast, or like the thing that people are most familiar with, which is sort of point-to-point request reply type style interactions. So this idea that we use, you know, our browser every day, we enter a URL in the browser and it, you know, loads a web page. That's a HTTP call, request reply interaction. No matter, you know, ignoring all the load balancers, all of the, you know, many replicas of the application service that is actually serving the traffic, fundamentally that interaction model is a point-to-point interaction. So in contrast, and that I think that's what people tend to, you know, understand, because we do it all, like we deal with that interaction style all the time. It would be similar in the real world, let's say, is that you're having a conversation with a single individual, and it's like you're, you know, talking back and forth and there's nobody else in the room. However, the second that you get up on a podium and you have a whole audience in front of you, now your speech, just like we're talking here, This is a PubSub interaction right now, because I am talking, you're both receiving, you know, this communication at the same time. barring latencies because of where we're physically located. But this is that style of interaction. So in a backend sense, it's this ability to say, I am, you know, publishing something, a message, whatever the communication medium is. And there's the ability on the other side for people to actively subscribe. And we can talk about, you know, there's terminology like topics and channels and subjects and all sorts of things. But there's some mechanism to say, I'm showing interest in this message that is being published and I'm listening for it. And so anybody who is actively subscribed at that time is able to receive that, basically a copy of that communication. And so you can, you know, fundamentally you have, rather than one-to-one communication, you have M-to-N communication. Any number of publishers, any number of subscribers, to be able to do sort of that communication style. So that would be like the maybe hopefully simplest definition of what that kind of pattern and mental model of that pattern is.
I've got, okay, cool. That makes sense. And I've got an analogy and I want to see if it holds up. You can tell me where it breaks down. So let's think of Zitter, right? Twitter X. If I DM you, that's kind of a point to point interaction, right? Like Lane is reaching out to Byron. This is what we're kind of used to with our HTTP request response system. Like, and you could argue that maybe there's 17 clones of Byron, but at the end of the day, like, I'm going to reach one of the clones of Byron with my DM and then he might respond. Right. Mm-hmm. Whereas a PubSub architecture might look more like a tweet in the sense that, like, I could just tweet something and then however many followers I have all sort of subscribed to that tweet and they'll each get their own like copy of it. So like I tweet something and now like 500 copies have been sent to my 500 followers. And then like you said, also on the publishing side, you can have M to N. So it's not just a variable number of subscribers, but you could have a variable number of publishers. So maybe that's like a Twitter community where like I'm part of a community and I have 10 other friends that are part of the community. We can all publish to the same community and just the followers of the community will all get that tweet. Is that kind of...
Yeah, for sure. Yeah. It like, just like Slack, you know, chat channels and all that kind of stuff. It's like that, like, and this is where we get into sort of this notion of like topics or channels or subjects. Like there's a unit of, there's basically some representation of the medium, the thing that is being joined. It's not a single message per se, but it's really like, you know, there's a subject that I'm publishing a message on behalf of. So, you know, like a mailing address or a physical home or something, or a Slack channel or what have you. And you can have multiple members, whether, and some members might only be sending messages in that channel. If it's like, you know, administrators, it's a read-only channel for a handful of people. So they're actively subscribed and observing these messages flowing in. So yeah, PubSub is everywhere, but I think it's like from a specifically with the backend development kind of audience, I think people are most familiar with HTTP, point-to-point interactions, gRPC maybe is another one. And, but yeah, we deal with, you know, M-to-N communication all day long everywhere. That's a great analogy.
I'm familiar with RabbitMQ, Kafka, Google PubSub, right? These are kind of implementations of the PubSub idea. They all have different features and stuff. Nats is one of those, right? It's another implementation. Could we maybe dive into like just very high level, like a very high level example of like what is the process of using Nats? Like someone publishing a message to a, I don't know if they're called topics in Nats. So like you publish a message and then some people subscribing, like what does that actually look like with a real world example? Like let's say that I have within my distributed backend one service that's responsible for sending emails to customers, but like lots of other areas of my system can kind of trigger events that would result in an email, right? Like maybe to use the example of Twitter, maybe a user followed me. And so that event happened and now I want an email to be sent. Just from a high level, how would we use Nats to accomplish something like that?
We're looking at Byron. I can either take that.
I talked a lot before, so go for it.
So I'm trying to see the social cues. I'm terrible at that. So I love the question because I'm about to launch into a whole set of other questions and reliability and durability and all these other things. And also definitions really, really matter. So PubSub architecture, in this case, NATS elevates itself away from Kafka and RabbitMQ and ZeroMQ and everything else because NATS historically has been misrepresented. And this is a great way to kind of actually maybe level up here a little bit, where it's not just PubSub. You know, PubSub is like the one of the just the kind of core functionality. And you have request reply patterns, which are those kind of unicast point to point, you know, systems. It's still PubSub. It's just, you know, you kind of limit your audience to one. But then we go a step further and then we can add streams. So, you know, your messages that go onto a subject can go into an ordered stream. And then we have a key value store, which is a projection of a stream. It's the same kind of technology. And then if you imagine then, well, what if I have multiple keys and they're in certain orders, could I put an object into there? Then we have the object store as well. So for me, PubSub architecture, it kind of depends. What are we talking about? A comparison, in which case it's like an apple versus a pineapple. It's kind of like, eh, might be fruity and nice, but the two very different beasts. So your question, I love it, right? So you have a signal from a platform, whether it's Twitter, whether it's LinkedIn or something, you want to send an email, you want to do some, you know, ConvertKit stuff, whatever, sign them up onto a mailing list. So the problem then becomes, well, how valuable is that operation to you? Do you want that thing to be durable? Do you need it to work? Or are you happy with it being, well, you know, what's the delivery mode? If the message makes it, it would be nice, but it's not critical. If I was building it, what I'd do is I'd take that message and I'd put it into a stream. So asynchronously grab that and make sure that that signal reached something that I'm going to be 100% confident of it happening. So I need at least, you know, at least once, or yeah, I guess at least once guarantees on that. And then what I'll have is I'll have a consumer. So in asynchronous time, it would then go, ah, I've got something in my hopper, in my stream, I need to do something with. I can then go and send an email. Now, what I'd do is I'd open up whatever it is, whether you've written an email application, whether you took some template code or whatever, but the process would look like, you know, create email template, send it to SMTP, whatever. Did it send, get an error code back? Yes. And then I'd acknowledge the message on the stream. So I've got a guaranteed process pipeline to send an email. But if we don't do any of that stuff and you go, well, what if it was just PubSub? Then A, we've got no guarantees of the message being handled. And then if the email system, that the component that sends emails offline, the messages are lost in the ether. But the second you insert the stream and you insert the durability, even if the email system goes offline and you've done some work on it, you go, oops, you know, bad Dave, I wrote some terrible code and I, you know, relaunched that and push it back out. The second it comes back online, it carries on where it left off and goes, hey, there's an email I need to go and transact upon. And then I've introduced these guarantees into the system. But then that introduces all sorts of fun problems. Like, you know, not many developers are good at kind of going, well, hang on a minute, this parallelism is a little bit mad, because you end up having to acknowledge messages and kind of manage your own, you know, reliance or reliability within the system. So does that help in terms of real world?
It definitely does. Let me, again, like, I like to just play back answers to make sure that I understand and hopefully to give kind of the audience a second take on whatever was being said. Okay, so instead of just taking my service that handles, like, you know, people being followed on Twitter and having that service either send an email directly or send an HTTP request over to a server that will send an email to alert somebody that they have a new follower, I'm going to publish a message to NATS. And for now, we can just, like, I'm at least thinking about NATS as just like some other system. And if I'm hearing right, that message can, depending on your configuration, kind of go sit in a stream or in, like, it's stateful, right? It's going to, like, sit in that system. And even if my email service happens to be offline at the moment, that message will sit there until the email service is back online, essentially, and ready to process that message. So, like, let's just say maybe it was rebooting, right? Maybe we'd push some changes to that service and we had to restart it. So now it's back online. It can actually go reach out to NATS, or maybe it's a push versus a pull. I don't know exactly how it works, but, like, let's just say it gets that message from the NATS system so that it can process it kind of asynchronously. And you're saying when it's done, it's going to tell NATS, hey, I processed this message, so that it doesn't, like, reprocess it. And that's kind of as opposed to if we didn't have that system in place, if my original, like, following service had just reached out via HTTP to my email service, it would have just, like, gotten a 500 error, right? Like, hey, the service is offline.
Yeah. I can go another level deeper, actually. So if we paint this from, let's paint by numbers. So your follower service does a HTTP call, because that's the sticky glue of the internet. It's a PVA glue of everything we do. So HTTP call comes in. Hey, Lane, new follower. Dave's followed you. Great. Now, what could happen here, let's say with the NAT solution that we've just talked about, your HTTP call gets an immediate response. I have got your message. Thank you very much. And you're off the hook. You know, go do your thing. But actually what will happen, we'll get that message. We'll put it into a stream. And as soon as it's into the stream or published to NATs, then we respond to you, which has decoupled your upstream follower service from the email chain. So your upstream service is, right, I've announced the signal. Dave's followed Lane. And then in the background, in your in your email server's leisure, it's notified, hey, I've got a new message in the queue. And that can be push or pull, by the way. Then that service will go off, send an email, and then it will acknowledge. I mean, you can configure different things, but in its most simple terms, it will acknowledge to NATs in that stream that this message has been sent. And then the kind of like an index moves forward, ready for the next one. So then you end up with this kind of reliable system. And then in terms of, well, what if, how does NATs handle reliability? Then we can also replicate that stream into different places as well. And you could also then, ready for this, distribute the number of workers, your email workers, in different data centers, different clouds, one on AWS, one in Azure, one in your mum's basement, you know, whatever, yeah, wherever you like. And NATs can handle that for you. And go on, Byron, taking deep breaths.
Go ahead, Byron. So, you got something to say.
I always have something to say. I think that's a good kind of baseline example, just to kind of connect, you know, back end developers. It's a very common thing that needs to get done. So it's a, I mean, there's always questions of saying, well, why can't I just like throw this thing in a database, you know? And there's different ways of implementing that particular solution. So we can kind of get into the nuances in a bit, but I wanted to step back just to say, kind of reiterate a little bit of what David said in terms of the set of NATS capabilities. And we get into this, you know, every technology can get kind of get bundled in a bucket and say, oh, you're just another one of these. I think where NATS is interesting, from a developer centric view right now, because we can get into, you know, topologies and all these other fancy things later. But from a developer standpoint, again, and tying it back into distributed systems, there's this spectrum of communication capabilities that NATS provides. So we have, you know, I typically refer to it as like stateless pub-sub messaging. So this idea that, and this was what it was originally designed for and optimized for, which is this idea that the components that are up, let's say your distributed system components, they're connected into NATs. They could be publishers, they could be subscribers. And out of the box, a publisher can literally say, send this message, which is just a byte slice at the end of the day. It's not opinionated about encoding or any of that type of stuff. It says, I'm publishing a message. Any active online subscribers are going to all receive that message by default. And it's optimized for not actually storing anything. So out of the gate. So no streams are involved in that. No persistence, no storage of any kind. And so,
like in our example from earlier, if the email service was offline, it kind of would just miss that message.
It would fire and forget. Yep. So you can think of it the way that NATS works with, and this is a common thing among most PubSub architectures, which is this idea of decoupling space. So with NATS, we refer to this as like subject-based addressing. So once you establish that initial TCP connection between the clients to the server, now NATS as a sort of, it's its own like network effectively. And all those clients have to care about is being able to publish and subscribe to subjects, as we refer to them. That's analogous to topics and channels a little bit. It's a little bit more fanciful. We can, again, get into that more. But the basic idea is that you're publishing and subscribing on these subjects, and they don't care where they physically are located. They could be all in process, to your point. Be all, you know, one monolithic process application, but they're still decoupled from NAT's perspective, from the location right. perspective. Or they could be completely distributed across, you know, any number of data centers out to vehicles, whatever, depending on the use case. But as long as they're connected into the one NAT system, whether it's a single server or like some large topology, all of the messages just flow transparently. So that's like the foundation of it. And, but as David said, this is like an app most wants delivery guarantee. So it's fire and forget. If the subscriber's offline and you connect up after the message has been published, you're not going to get it. NATS doesn't persist by default in that case. So for use cases that expect all of these components or have enough, you know, high availability or redundancy of components that will, one of which will receive a message. We have this notion of like a queue group, which is like, you know, a basically free, you know, distribution, high availability of a set of members of a group that one of them would receive it depending on which one is online. Without any additional dependencies, you can basically build up your components like that, join these queue groups, and then one of them will probably be online and they'll receive the message. They can do the work, whatever. So it's super high throughput, super low latency type of messaging from that standpoint. And it's completely location transparent. Again, no, they don't have to care or know where clients and publishers are physically located. So that's like, yeah, go ahead.
No, I just want to make like, there was a lot there and I want to make sure that some of it makes sense. So would we say like did you say location transparent? Was that the terminology or location independent? I've worked in microservices architectures where like, say we had like seven different like quote unquote services. And if you haven't seen the Krazam YouTube video on microservices, like you might want to pause this video and go watch it because it's hilarious and then come back and finish this episode. But like seven different microservices, and they're all kind of responsible for different things. And I've definitely worked in systems where we don't use a pub-sub architecture. And each service like has to have coded into like its environment variables, the kind of URLs, right? The endpoints of the other services so that it can explicitly send data across the wire to these other systems. If I'm hearing properly, one of the benefits, like the location independent thing, is like I really just need to know where NATS is so that I can communicate with NATS. And that, at least from a configuration standpoint, can simplify a lot of things.
Yeah, 100%. And again, we can get into this, but in general, like people think hear about service discovery, you hear about, you know, needing to know like whether you're using service discovery, which is another component you would have to deploy in your infrastructure. You have DNS, you know, all of this stuff to be able to resolve, whether it's internal DNS or external, whatever, however you're managing that. The key thing is that like you literally need like one DNS entry for where NATS lives. And you can have a whole bunch of, you know, A records, like if it's replicated, you have different entry points or whatever. But once it's connected, none of the components, the clients that are connected have to know or care or do any kind of resolution of IP, DNS, any of that. That's one of those things where it's like significantly simplifies in an actual production kind of environment where you have a lot of moving parts. You might have multiple teams. Even if you're a single person, it's still one less thing that you have to, you know, deal with. But it reduces the operational complexity. It reduces, you know, the number of components in your infrastructure. You know, the funny thing, which is always true, is that DNS is always the problem. That goes away, you know, as long as you can connect to NATS, you're off to the races. So that's like, that's more, I would say it's less of a developer centric thing. Cause we try to have like, when we talk about NATS, we try to like break it up into sort of different audience types, because you have like the developer, which I care about building my application. These are the primitives that NATS gives me. I can choose, you know, stateless messaging. I can choose streams and consumers, which give me durability, which means I'm not just decoupling space, which is the location transparent aspect. I'm also decoupling time. I don't need to be online at the time a message is published. It'll be stored and I can deal with that when I'm ready, kind of thing, or when I'm back online. So you're decoupling space, decoupling time. And then we have these other two client abstractions on top, which are very common primitives that people need for basic state management, which is like a KV abstraction and an object store abstraction that actually is built on top of the stream layer itself. So there's a whole bunch of, you know, configuration options and things like that for the stream layer. It is very different from other stream implementations or like write ahead log implementations or log structures like a Kafka. It's more like a message store, like a proper message store. You can actually delete individual messages and things like that. And there's all sorts of fun things in there.
Oh, interesting.
But yeah, but you do have, you know, the whole point of rambling on about this is that like the developer has like these suite of primitives, these capabilities that are very common when you're building any kind of application. And you can just use like one API effectively, one client SDK. We're multi-language, you know, Go, Python, a whole bunch. We have like 11 official ones, I think, and then a whole mess of other community contributed ones. So you can still pick and choose which, you know, language you want, but it's all, you have the same client abstraction using the same server at the end of the day.
And for my audience, most importantly, you have a Go SDK, and Nats is written in Go, right?
Yep. It is. Cool. Yeah.
Yeah. No, I always like to promote technologies that use my favorite programming language. That's pretty cool. Cause I think Rabbit is Erlang.
Sorry, Lane.
Oh yeah. No, I was going to say, I think Rabbit is Erlang, and I was talking with you earlier. Java is Kafka. I have no idea what Google's PubSub is. But it's cool to see that we have a PubSub system written in Go. I want to just really quickly, I feel like we've talked about some of the like tangible like features of PubSub over HTTP, right? Things like the resiliency, location independence. I want to dive in to a very tangible example of like when in a real application would you care to switch from like microservices that are communicating either over HTTP or gRPC, right? Single point communication, to something like NATS.
Yeah, I've got a very simple answer to that. And the second that you take a look at a monolith and you decide to split some of the functionality out, then it's probably a good time to do it. I think me and Byron have spoke at length and even on other podcasts about this. Like, imagine that you have an application that you've taken from a monolith. You have a landing functional endpoint, whether that you access it over HTTP or you know, whatever, gRPC, who cares? But there is a landing function, and it might be, hey, you know, give me my settings profile for a SaaS or, you know, whatever it is. And that data might get sourced from multiple locations. But the thing is, there's a number of procedural steps. One, go do database dip over there. Two, go get, I don't know, billing data. Is can the user even see this stuff? Have they got a valid subscription? Whatever it is. The second that you start taking apart that application, then NATS has a home, in my opinion, because you end up having kind of like, I always call them front door functions, but something that's got the business logic. You know, it's like, right, I need to go and get these things and assemble this stuff. And you can do it one or two ways. It's a little bit like in networking where you've got source routing. You can kind of go, my schema for the data that I want is X. So it's like a, whatever it is, you know, JSON schema, XML schema. And then you can say, and I'm going to literally pass this thing. I'm going to throw it at the first function. And that's going to, you know, fulfill part of it. And that one's going to throw it at the second one. And you end up with this kind of like fulfillment ring, which is kind of crazy. Or you got the scatter and gather approach. So your landing zone, your front door function grabs that and then fires off all the separate kind of requests in the background, waits for everything to come back in, reassembles the answer, and then pushes it back, you know, back out. I think the second you start doing anything like that, NATS is kind of a really, sorry, yeah. NATS, I use NATS and obviously PubSub architectures interchangeably. But even if I was trying to find, you mentioned gradient earlier, and I love that. If I was trying to go from monolith to something a little bit more scalable, what I'd start doing is I break apart the direct paths of communication in a single application. So you take something like Go, I might create a bunch of Go routines that all have their own, you know, kind of NAT subjects where you might subscribe. It might be listening for an email thing or listening for, you know, authentication or whatever it is. So there you have a single distributable program that doesn't communicate internally, but it's actually communicates across a network. So what you might have is one instance that communicates with itself over NATS. Now that sounds mad, but you can turn bits of your program on and off with flags, and then you could, you know, copy that and place it in different locations. And all of a sudden you've got this means to scale out. So I think to really wind it up, I mean, I'd kind of start these days by thinking, how do I design my program to work effectively with NATs, which means that I can put it wherever I want to put it in the future. And that can backfire because, you know, you try and kill something you've written like that and it's actually really hard. You realize I've got it running on a Raspberry Pi at home on an EC2 instance on my MacBook and you think, where are all these instances running? Obviously, NATs helps you with that. But yeah.
You made a bold claim and I want to make sure that I understood it properly. Uh-oh. Because it's big if true. So essentially what I heard was, if you have a microsystem, a microservices architecture, in other words, your app isn't just one monolith running on one server, or I mean, you could have a monolith that is distributed across multiple servers, but the idea is it's the same code, right, running on multiple servers, that we would consider that a monolith versus, you know, different services that do different things. If you have those different services that do different things, are you saying that there's basically no place for this like synchronous point-to-point communication? Like essentially, if you're crossing that threshold, it is time for PubSub or it is time for NATs.
So I'll jump in. So I think it's not an either or. So again, if we separate out the interaction style of a request reply versus saying, now I have to do everything asynchronous. Those are two different things. The problem with a straight up HTTP, and patterns, interaction style versus protocols. Let's, you know, decouple those two things. NATS has its own protocol. It has a server, it's a broker effectively, and so on. Whereas with an HTTP server, you are literally hosting the HTTP server and you are mounting endpoints into your server, whether you're using a PaaS, whether you're using Lambda, whatever, you're like an API gateway, you're composing these endpoints and you're effectively needing to take in that traffic and then go do something with that. So in a traditional thing, like a Rails, like a Django, whatever, or even a standard Go, you know, web server, you're mounting these endpoints and you're expecting to respond in some way. You could still model an asynchronous behavior in the sense that our HTTP request comes in, I, you know, store it in a database somewhere, I put it, store it safely, and I respond, but maybe I'm not going to get to that work. As David said, we can model that very easily with NATS as well, with a durable stream. But you can still choose to have point-to-point interaction styles with NATS as well. So because we said it's M to N, you could have M and N equal one, and then you could still have a synchronous one-to-one interaction.
Got it. But like you have now the ability waiting for an acknowledgement or something. Like
exactly.
Like and we actually have a built-in. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. Sorry, so we actually have a built-in. Yeah. We have a built-in part of all the client SDKs. There's literally as we typically off the NATS connection, the client connection, there's literally a helper method that says request. And it does exactly that because people and you pass the subject, you pass a payload, you pass a timeout. And it'll sit there, your client will lock up and sit there and wait and for a response to come back, because that's a very common, it's like you're asking a question, you want a response on demand. You don't want to, you know, do all this choreography of events and, you know, it'll get to me eventually. But the challenge with it starting with HTTP, and again, as David said, HTTP is the glue of the web. So we're not dissing on that. But if you're choosing a backend protocol, a backend technology to connect all your things, you immediately limit yourself by choosing HTTP or gRPC versus something that implements an actual end-to-end communication style. And you don't have to go, you know, right into the microservices realm. That's not what PubSub does not imply, you know, microservices. You can, for example, still create like from a physical deployment unit style. You can still, for example, and this is a maybe mostly Go community, you can embed the NAT server if you want. You could go real extreme. You can embed the server in process. You can embed your client applications. You can have, you know, n number of subscribers that still decouple all the subjects and, you know, the work that they have to do. Every client subscription actually does under the hood run in its own Go routine by default. So you have all of the concurrency already baked in and you can deploy that. But over time, if you say, I have a, you know, this subscription is actually taking up a lot of memory, this little thing, I need to break that out. You
got it. So
you still have a NAT server. You still have the endpoint to connect to. You break out your client code into a new deployable unit. You deploy that up. It's still connecting. It's still subscribed to the same subjects. You're not changing anything. It doesn't care about location. You just point it to the NAT server that's, in this case, embedded. Eventually, you can say, I actually need a HA NATS cluster. Great. Break out the embedded server. Deploy that independently. Still just a NATS client connection. So you can choose to break it up over time. But starting with that model, you don't have to change, like, versus, you know, the extreme contrast, which is like, I have a Rails app, a Django app or something, and it's like, I have method invocations between all my components. You could have a really great modularized code base, but transitioning from a function call to a network call is a completely different thing. And you're going to have to rewrite your application. So here it's like, you can have this sort of, you know, asynchrony already baked in, or concurrency model already baked in using NATs and having all that decoupling, but you still have a single deployable unit, and then you can gradually break it out over time if you need to.
Yeah. Right. I might have confused things earlier on. Sorry, by the way. Let me just explain this and I promise I'll yield. Things when we talk about PubSub, I think naturally think about all the menu items that NATS offers and not just PubSub. And what I do is I kind of jump the gun sometimes or shoot myself in the face with a foot gun. That's the other trick I'm pretty good at doing. Apologies for the language on that, because NATS itself is like this interest network. So you can do, you know, fan in, fan out. You can have point-to-point communications over NATS.
Fail
to explain.
Yeah, no, I think you were talking about exactly what I was trying to get at, which is like, and it's good, Byron, that you jumped in and mentioned that NATS doesn't just do PubSub, but it is what I'm trying to get at with my question, which is like, we've got PubSub things, which is like M2N, asynchronous, right? Like, you architect your application a certain way, and then we have synchronous, which it sounds like you could just do the synchronous thing through NATS anyways, which is great. It's a feature of NATS. But what I'm trying to get at for my audience is like, when do I need to do one or the other? And obviously, like, I'm glad that you mentioned that, like, we can just use NATS and you can choose, right? Either I need a synchronous, either I need to use NATS synchronously for like immediate request response, or I need to use its asynchronous features. But like, when would I use one or the other?
Yeah, it's a great question. It does boil down. I mean, it's the it depends type of thing, but you can think of, you know, which is an unfortunate answer, but it boils down to, and David mentioned this in his example before, which is like, there's two things. Does the work need to get done right now? So if it doesn't, then you need to put it somewhere and then you can reply back. So that's more of like, you know, request reply style, but on the back end, you're choosing to be asynchronous and actually performing the work. You're still acknowledging maybe back to the client. So it's still technically, you know, a single interaction. That could be one thing, right? So, you know, click follower, it's still coming through. It's about you and, you know, David's the follower and I need to, like, you know, build up some cash now because, or add your tweets to his feed or something, or whatever they call them these days, X's.
Zeets.
Just made it up.
So there's like that style. So the interaction style is still request reply, but you're choosing on the back end to be asynchronous in how you handle that work. So there's like that bit, but then there's the other sort of component, which is like, as a client, and this is something, again, it's like fuzzy because you can't do this with HTTP. HTTP always expects a reply, right? You can't just say, I am sending a request and I don't care. Like, the client could cut the connection off, you know, break my, you know, whatever, but it's not designed for that. It's designed to be inherently request reply. Whereas with NATS, you publish the client literally fires and forgets. It hits the server. I don't care anymore. It's out in the ether, and whoever is interested in that is going to receive it. And this is most applicable for like broadcasting events, broadcasting, you know, right. clickstream data, events, whatever it might be. But it's like, I am literally just relaying information. Who's ever online, whoever cares, and whoever is online could be a durable stream behind the scenes. A durable stream internally in the NAT server is actually just another subscriber. So it's not just, it might not be a client application. It's literally an internal subscriber. Just my job is to store this data into a durable stream. So it's like you have this flexibility of saying, I'm just publishing, giving that information out. I don't expect anything, any response, but anyone who is interested in this, there you go.
So I've got an example later.
Yeah, go ahead. Yeah.
Sorry. This is going to happen a lot with me and Byron. Sorry. It's like kind of like clones in some ways, but I talk way more than he does. HTTP examples. I think HTTP is a great thing to talk about. So let's say if we talk about the same strawman application in two different ways. Number one, so I've got a really crappy web service. You put a description of something that you want to know about in, and then you click submit. What happens, obviously, the browser then, it might do a post, and then it will sit there waiting for a response. And there are confines in the browser, like a timeout that's just going to, it's just going to go, oh, you know, no connection. Well, it's going to, first of all, it's going to do a DNS lookup, then it's going to do a post, and then it's going to sit there and spin and wait. And a lot of kind of naive designs, it might be the HTTP handler gets the information, it gets a post, it might, you know, take the data values out of the form, and then it goes and does some work on the back end. And then what it does, it's kind of like, yeah, screw you, browser. And it leaves a connection open waiting. And then it goes off and does some back end work. And eventually the answer comes through and it goes, yeah, here you go. Here's the answer. Transaction complete. Now, you could use NATs in that design. So you could, like, you know, your front end function keeps the data, keeps a connection open. And then it sits there and says, right, I am now going to do either a request reply. So we think about it point to point on NATs, or a pub sub, and go, right, I need an answer, please, for this input. And then it can sit there and wait. And then it will wait for the answer. And once it gets the answer, it can respond. But mode two of that, depending on what you want to do, is your web app could fire off the post. And then the response comes back and it says, now listen or watch this key value, or listen for this subject. And it could subscribe or listen for an inbox. So then what happens is your browser's gone, I'm happy, I've fired off the first request. Bang, it's gone off, and now I'm sitting here. But my web logic, my, you know, whatever it is, my React app, my Next.js app, or whatever, can sit there now and wait for an event to come back. So you've decoupled things. So even if that first connection is, you know, whatever, it's gone, who cares? You've now moved on, and you've got this distributed workflow by design, where your app can listen for, you know, event coming in from the back end in its own time and space, which means you could even do a refresh on the browser, and providing that some local state's been set, it can carry on listening to what it was listening for. And you can get on a plane, you can go on a train, and you get back and, oh, magic, my application sorted out. You've designed within the constraints, but NATs can provide for both patterns. So it's not really when should you use it. It's like, well, I think Byron said it probably the best way, in a much easier way. It depends. What are you designing for? What user experience do you want? How reliable do you want it to be?
That's a fantastic example. The problem with a lot of these conversations is, like, the right answer is it depends, but, like, I don't really care, because that's not interesting. I like to come up with, like, rules of thumb. So, like, we can just kind of leave at the door, like, yes, it depends, there's a billion edge cases, but, like, what are some rules of thumb that we can kind of talk about, so that at least from a high level we can understand when it would be, like, good to at least start investigating this other route. So, like, I think one of you said, I think it was Byron, you said, like, do I need something to happen immediately, or do I need something, or like, do I not really care when it happens? So I think a great example of this is in boot dev, when you're doing lessons in the app, you're completing exercises. And in the first iteration of boot dev, we had the HTTP handler that you would post your answer to respond with any, like, earned achievements that you unlocked when you submitted that answer, right? So submit answer, backend does a bunch of logic and responds with, like, oh, you happened to unlock this achievement and you earned 3 gems and 200 XP. In a later iteration of boot dev, that started to get fairly complex. And we realized we didn't need, like, all of that stuff, A, to happen within the same HTTP response. And B, we actually needed to trigger other things off of, like, that submission. So we did end up transitioning part of our system to a pub sub event. So essentially what happens now is you submit your assignment. All you get back is, like, was the assignment correct or not? And then on the back end, if the assignment was correct, that message is published. And we have other services that are looking to check, like, oh, were achievements unlocked? Was XP unlocked, right? Did you level up? Those events are transmitted through our backend system, and anything that's unlocked gets pushed back down through a WebSocket. So like David said, you can like refresh your browser, and even if it takes a couple seconds to process all of those events, like those things are going to get pushed back down to you on the client, you know, eventually. And I think eventually is a really good operative word for some of this stuff as like a heuristic. Like if you only care eventually if that email gets sent, right? If it only, if like it just needs to go out sometime within the next couple minutes, right? Then it could be a good candidate for this kind of asynchronous stuff.
Yeah, for sure. And that's a, you hit on a key point there, which is when you design a system, let's say from a new feature, whatever, it doesn't matter what it is. It's always very short-sighted to assume that some event that occurs in your system, there's only ever going to be one thing that is interested in that. Because yeah. Even if you have the use case of saying, I need to log these events, I need to, you know, archive these events, I need, yeah, two different handlers that this like user registered. There's a whole bunch of stuff that goes on as a result of, you know, a user registering on a website. It's not just one thing, or it's not just going to be one component that can do all the work. Maybe you can start with that and that's fine, but there's going to be, you know, this event is going to be listened to, subscribed to, have different components will have interest in that thing that happened in your system. And you want to be able to design up front to allow for that when that time comes. And frankly, it's no more difficult to start with something like NATS versus going the HTTP route, you know, but it's like you have, you know, much more adaptability, scalability, and evolvability of your system when you have this pub/sub sort of thing baked into it, and you still can satisfy the request reply point to point interactions and things like that. And just as a final sort of real world analogy, I think that we can think of the asynchrony, is like, yeah, if you're at an ATM and you want to get cash out, you're gonna sit there and wait until you get your money. You're not gonna be like, all right, put my card in, I'll walk away, you know, go, and somebody else comes by and grabs your money. That's ridiculous. However, when you place an order at Starbucks at a restaurant, you place your order. Now it's going through this whole pipeline of things. You go sit down. That's an asynchronous flow. Like there's other maybe synchronous behind the scene interactions. Again, it's a choice. It's a choice of how these components fundamentally talk to one another, depending on what you want to achieve. If you can keep just pushing things down into a queue that then get picked off asynchronously, great. That's just like you have, you know, when you're on the line, cooking line, it's like you're putting this ticket next to the next station and you're preparing your plate, whatever it may be. And it's like, I've done my work. Now I push it onto the next queue kind of thing. So you can imagine sort of all of these real world scenarios where this asynchrony comes into place. But there's still like order to that pipeline. For example, you're not going to do, you know, the final placement of a, you know, little microgreens on the plate first before you actually put the slop on. So it's one of those things where you still can have order, you can still have synchrony, you can have asynchrony. That's why it's like, yeah, how would you choose to model it? And the thing with all of the NATS primitives that it provides is like you do actually have choice, rather than saying, well, I guess everything is synchronous HTTP and or point to point, and I'm like, that's what I have to work with.
That's a fantastic example. I'm gonna do the same Starbucks example specifically. Yeah, go ahead, David.
No, sorry. I think there's a little bit of latency. Obviously, I'm in the UK, so I'm on like, you know, the terrible island out in the middle of nowhere. Sorry, Lane.
You're good.
I'm kind of excited actually, because I've got thoughts bubbling away. There's often confusion in distributed system design between, and I'm going to use these terms very, very carefully, between control plane and data plane. So when you build something that, you know, you've got an imperative list of stuff that needs to be done, your, you know, ever expanding if else list of, you know, tasks, you want those tasks to run as fast as absolutely possible. So even though we decouple time asynchronously, let's say in the email, you know, the email example, because it's a really good example, we're not saying it will eventually get there, because even though you've broken the system fundamentally at how it communicates, it's now a network call and not in path over a, you know, PCI bus or whatever, you will probably not notice any time delays. We're not kind of saying it's no longer important. Ah, it's okay, get there tomorrow. The chances are it will still arrive whether you're running the monolith or the, you know, modular monolith or a microservices architecture. So your data plane is still intact, but it's now network-based and not chip-based. So there's that.
Slow, and then, any slower than it would have been, really.
Right? Exactly. Yes, it's conceptually different, but the way it actually manifests itself in reality is you've got a follower, you've got an email. So that's kind of, I think that distinction is always worth mentioning. But then you've got the kind of control plane aspect, which is where, you know, what if actually we have a stream of data being populated in one region and we want it to be replicated into another? We have an eventually consistent copy across the RAF network. But that's not necessarily going to impact that flow of you have a follower and an email. It might be you're doing some analytics somewhere else, or you're making a backup. So it's relevant to what aspect and what view you have of the design at that moment in time. It's not like, you know, well, I'll just go and throw it on a queue and don't worry about it. It's not that. And you know what I said earlier on about the Google thing with the boomerang and it's going to come back? I think this is the moment it comes back. So let's say you have a follower and you go, oh, I want to send an email. What you might do is you might set a timer and you might go, right, if I don't get a response from my email system in 3 minutes to say the email's either been sent or there's an error code, I'm now going to email the administrator and say, ah, there's a problem, the email didn't go out. Or in Google's case, I'm going to set a timer for the worst answer possible. You know, the first answer, not the one that takes a few hops and, you know, a few recursions to get the good answer, where it says, you know what, nothing else came back. The penguin, it's a bag of something alive. Terrible answer, but you've got an answer. And that's all of a sudden you start having to think about that to prevent those issues where, well, the email might never get there. Well, that's just distributed systems. No, it's just bad design. So sorry, Lane, I was kind of like jumping all over there, but like bursting with useless rhetoric.
No, that's a really good point. It doesn't really slow down. And I think I used the wrong word. It's not that it slows anything down, but in my mind, it's like it could be if it wanted to, if it needed to be. Like, so for example, when I upload a video to YouTube, I don't know if this is actually the case, but I know that you could build it this way. I use some sort of HTTP method, some sort of synchronous method to like start a video upload and the video gets uploaded. But then some like background job starts where it processes that video and it like compresses it, right? And it optimizes it for all the different ways that it can serve that video to customers. And all of a sudden, I'm not like, I don't need to keep my browser open for that anymore. Like that's happening in Google's backend. And eventually when it's done processing, ping, like I get an email, right? So like that's an instance where it does happen to take a long time. Or in your example of like someone following me and then me instantly getting an email, like you said, both of those use cases are supported, right? By like the PubSub architecture. So it's not necessarily that the PubSub makes it slower, but like now I have that ability. Whereas if I had a synchronous system, I would kind of have to just like sit there and wait, and my HTTP request probably times out before whatever background job that's happening actually finishes, right?
Yeah, sure. Yeah, and yeah, I mean, man, we could go on about this for another 10 episodes, to be honest. So yes, when you're a YouTube video where you chunk it up, your browser might have the job of, and you might see a notification, you know, don't close this browser tab, because what it's doing is chunking and uploading. But beyond that point, when there's like maybe a hash exchange, you know, it says, oh, okay, yeah, I've got it. You can now disconnect. And then it's on its system. It's in a job queue. It might be, you know, some version of what we've been talking about. You know, there's a worker queue, pulling chunks, reassembling them, compressing them, rendering, you know, expanding, and then putting them onto their CDN. Yeah, then absolutely. Then we've got this lovely, you know, time asynchronous split, but there's still a handover of responsibility from one system to another, even though the paradigm's, you know, kind of the same all the way through. Yeah.
There's two very important questions that I want to get to before we end. And I know we're almost 80 minutes into this thing. This has been a great episode. Question number one, respectively, and we can start with Byron because we just heard from David. What is your most unpopular opinion when it comes to like back-end architectures and PubSub and microservices and that sort of thing? Unpopular engineering opinion.
Oh boy, I have two bangers, I think. The one is partially what we've been sort of talking to. And this is, again, like HTTP exists and it was originally created for the web. That was what it was designed for. And people have picked that up and said, let me build a distributed system using it as the fundamental protocol. And I don't fault people for doing it because it's familiar. It's what everybody learns in boot camps, you know, all of the web, any kind of web development, you're going to get introduced to this. You're not going to be introduced to all of these other, you know, PubSub technologies and such. So I don't fault anyone for it. But my unpopular opinion in that respect is that I think it's a terrible idea to use HTTP as long as you, you know, learn something. And that's, I'm biased, but I've also been using NATS for 7 years and I've done plenty of, you know, web application development and distributed systems and using cloud providers and all sorts of things. I think NATS is a very, very sensible starting point that people should genuinely consider as an alternative, an alternative starting point. My second, real quick, unpopular opinion, completely unrelated to this because we didn't talk about it, is, and if listeners don't know or watchers don't know about event sourcing and CQRS, command query responsibility segregation, and domain-driven design, things like that, there's a whole bunch of these words that once you learn them and you adopt them and really understand them, I think it's a fundamentally better way of thinking about a problem space, breaking it down and using, you know, proper domain language rather than just saying everything's a CRUD app. And, you know, it's just, I'm going to use my internal terminology and it's not going to be the terminology of the business or the use case that I'm actually solving for. And I think this notion of event sourcing as a quick 20-second thing for people who don't know, it is fundamentally a different persistence model than, you know, an update in place database or like I have a record and I'm changing a column value, you know, and at any given point in time, I only have the current version or current snapshot of what that state was. You don't actually have any of the historical stuff. You don't even know how that state got to where it was. And the reality with event sourcing is really the acknowledgement that events happen whether you choose to acknowledge them or not in your system, whether you choose to store them and you know, throw them away. Like that's a choice, but events are happening whether you like it or not. And it's just like, you should acknowledge them because then if you have a log of events, you can actually see how the state ultimately, you know, resulted at the end rather than going back in your database table and saying, how did that bug happen? I don't know what led up to that. And that happens all the time. And it's like, but if you had, you know, the log of events and then you're computing the state relative to that, you can still use a database and materialize it and to allow for SQL queries. But, you know, if you don't have that log of events leading up to it, you're kind of in the dark. So I think it helps with better design and understanding the domain well, because you have to use the language, you have to think about what an event means, you have to think about a command or a query and what that means. And your choice of, you know, how you want to materialize things, query things, that's still up to choice. You can still use databases, you can use Mongo, you can use whatever you want, Dynamo. And but right. So that's one of those unpopular opinions, because I think people can get really heated about it and they're like, it's overly complicated. It's just like, well, you know, experience, it takes time to learn and discipline to adopt these methods and to learn them for sure. Just like anything else. But like, if you're brand new to programming, you didn't know what the heck a CRUD app was. You don't know what HTTP was. You don't know all of these like JavaScript frameworks. It's no different. It's just a different suite of methods and technologies that you have to learn. But it's anyway, you have to be pragmatic with things, but I think as a starting point, like that's generally my go-to because it helps me think about the problem better.
Right.
So that's maybe an unpopular.
No, that's great. HTTP is bad. Event sourcing is good. We'll have to do a follow-up episode later on event sourcing actually dive into it.
But, sure.
Cool. David, what are your, what's your unpopular opinion?
Just one. I'm English. I've got all the popular opinions. I'm like the master chief collector of unpopular opinions. I've got one big gripe in life. And it's just take a step back. I'm putting a positive spin. The gripe. People who don't take a step back and breathe and think about what it is that they're trying to do. So they'll just kind of start writing code and go, just ship it. Yeah, but it kind of goes back to what I was saying earlier on. Like, I will center a design around, well, how do I make sure this thing is resilient to a little bit of failure? how can I just scale it just above, you know, one user? If I start there and then, you know, next week I take a copy of it and shove it on a different VM and it works, happy days, or I shove it into a Lambda or, you know, whatever. My biggest gripe is those that rush in design and ask all the questions based on their, just going to say it, crappy design and blame, you know, something else because of naivety, whatever. Yeah. So that's my big thing. I see too much of it, and it's no finger pointing either. It's just everywhere. You know, you see justifications for a bad decision. It's like, well, you can just say that was a bad decision. Let's go back and rethink that. Yeah. Just take a breather. Have a think.
Or do what
Byron does and go for a run. Yeah, think about it. What are you trying to achieve? That. Do you know all the answers to what your expectations are? Like, I build things on my own a lot, and I have to sit down with a whiteboard and go, what am I building here? What's this for? Am I tickling just a need to build something, or am I actually serving a purpose? And what does that purpose look like? Is it important? How important? Yeah. And once you get to truth, then, you know, suddenly you find your design can be a little bit simpler or, you know, whatever. But yeah, take a breather, step back, think.
I like that a lot, and I especially like it in the realm of rewrites. So, like, you've got some messy code base, and I've been a part of several rewrites where I think if we had taken just, like, we had a working system, and we knew it was going to bump into, or it was bumping into some, like, either scalability limits or architectural limits. It's like, we don't need to rewrite it today. Like, let's figure out what the problems are. Take a second, like rewriting or re-architecting or refactoring. Like, those are big jobs sometimes. And kicking off a 4-month project without at least taking a day to think about it, I completely agree. That's a great one.
What about you, Lane? Come on, fire us one. You've got to have one or two.
Gosh, nobody's ever held up the mirror on the show. Oh, man. At the moment, I would say... Oh man, is it going to be unpopular? Give me just a second to gather an unpopular one. The listeners have heard a lot of my popular opinions. In the Go community, I do think I have an unpopular opinion. In the Go community, my first biggest gripe with Go is the lack of enum types. I wish we had like some types, union types. My second biggest gripe with Go at the moment is the context package. Request context, the standard library's context. It is used to store dynamic values, and that kills the benefits of static typing. And that drives me absolutely bonkers. I don't have like a solution to this. I don't know how we would fix it. But my unpopular opinion is that the context package is good for timeouts and sucks at basically everything else. There it is.
I like that.
That's funny. The first time that I learned, and I've been a Go user pre 1.0, but when the context package, which I know was later in life, was introduced, I never personally once used the value method to store any data because it never made sense to me. It's like, be explicit with passing data, you know, and I know that's the whole point. It's like, propagate this context. It's like, you could really abuse that and just like hide all this stuff, you know? Yes. You can make a whole struct value and you just have all these fields and I'm populating along this call stack. And then it's like, you have no visibility into that. It's very weird. I never understood, you know, the real true motivation of it. Like I understood the reason, but like, was this not like David says, step back. Was this a good idea? Like, let's see. I think the timeout and it's like, the intuition is, you know, if you're propagating a timeout or propagating a deadline, why can't we just propagate other values that are just user provided? Maybe that was as simple as it is. I don't know.
I think there are cases where it is one, maybe,
but I'll stop.
Yeah. I need to do another episode on the context package as well. Cause it drives me nuts. It's used for like middleware, right? To like add values to like handlers. But I try to avoid it like the plague, at least for that use case. I do use it for timeouts, of course. I'm not a crazy person. Cool. Thank you guys so much for coming on. Before we end, I want you to each tell the audience where you can find your stuff online, where you can find Nats, Synadia, like just plug all the stuff that you want. My audience of kind of, you know, just starting out back-end developers to be able to find resources about what you guys are working on.
Sure. saw the hand. So yeah, I have not blogged whatsoever recently, but I do have a website, just byronruth.com. I have some existing, I actually transferred a lot when I joined Synadia. I started the Nats newsletter, on my blog before I joined, and then I transferred all those assets over to the Synadia, website. And I've been maintaining that ever since. I forget, we're up to quite a few, year and a half to 2 years of worth of newsletters for Nats. So that's a really good resource for people. And then I'm on X, Twitter, whatever. The handle is it comes across terrible in audio, but the devil, but it's the developer. So it's DEVEL.
Oh, nice. Yeah.
So I got that handle very early on. Yeah. So I'm on there and LinkedIn as well. But yeah, we have nats.io is the website, and synadia.com is that. And then I'll kick it over to David.
No worries, I can hear my wife shout me for dinner, so that's well timed. So I'm on X, Twitter. If I say Zitter, it just sounds like I'm swearing. I forgot what I am. What am I? At dave.dev, DAVEDOTDEV. I've also got the dave.dev. There's a blog up there. Me and Byron host as well the Nats FM podcast. So you can go to just nats.fm and catch me and him rambling about more of this kind of thing as well. I think Byron, you covered everything else off. You've got the natsbyexample.com site, which is fantastic for getting to grips. Plenty of Go examples on there. And you can just take code examples and run with a lot of the stuff that we've been talking about here. And for the documentation, just head over to the Nats site and you'll find lots of stuff there as well. So yeah, thanks for having us. This has been cool.
Yeah. No, thank you guys so much for coming on. I will put links to all those things down in the description below. So for anyone who is having a hard time typing domain names out of audio, it'll all be down where you can click on it. Thanks again, guys. I'll see you later.
Cool. Thanks so much. Thank you.